because it is unusual to deliver a totally new concept. For us, awareness is our biggest challenge. And then after awareness is something we call legitimacy. So most people who need our product actually don't even know it exists. The ones who do need it, who don't own it, that know it exists, don't own it because they don't believe it's actually going to deliver what it delivers. So we haven't convinced them of the legitimacy of the product. And those are our two biggest marketing tasks. And they're really hard. And if you look at the history of products like ours, whether it's mountain bikes, electric bikes, stand-up paddleboards, snowboarding, like every 5 to 10 years, there's some new category that develops within outdoor recreation and fitness. And it, you know, it's an overnight success. Well, stand-up paddleboards have been around for 50 years before they actually became popular. Mountain bikes have been around for 12 before they became popular. Snowboarding have been around for 40 years before it became popular. I mean, these things just take a really long time, or they can take a really long time to develop, to overcome those two issues, awareness and legitimacy.
Brian Pate was a runner who couldn't run anymore. He was forced into using elliptical trainers in the gym, but when he grew tired of the inside scenery, he went looking for one that he could ride outside. And when he didn't find one, he invented one. On this episode of What I Wish I Knew with Mike Irwin and Simon Daw, Brian describes the journey. Welcome to What I Wish I Knew with Mike Irwin and Simon Daw. We're excited today to invite Brian Pate to join us. And Brian has a very unique background. So he was a graduate of Stanford and Columbia Law School. He was a military intelligence officer in the U.S. Marine Corps. He was a consultant with McKinsey and served as a clerk in the U.S. District Court. But he's one of those people that is unusual in that he saw something that didn't exist, and then he essentially invented a category which is now, you know, sold around the world thanks to the work of Brian and his team, and that's elliptical bicycles. So Brian is the founder and CEO of Elliptigo, which sells elliptical cycles and stand-up bikes, and it's something that has really, you know, caught the eye of a lot of people. And Brian, I was running in Germany, in Berlin, probably 2 or 3 years ago, and I'm running down, you know, the road, and then all of a sudden somebody goes zooming by on one of your products. I'm like, hey, I know that. So Brian, welcome to What I Wish I Knew.
Right on. Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
So I kind of gave the real basics, but that's really not a fair rendition of your story. So tell us how you got here.
You know, it's been a really weird path, as you articulated. Grew up here in San Diego and then went to Stanford for undergraduate on an ROTC scholarship. So I knew I was going to the Marine Corps before I got to Stanford, which made my Stanford experience a little different in the sense I had a shaved head. You know, I was going through ROTC and wearing a uniform and those sorts of things, but also I didn't have to get a job. So all my friends had to get a job. All my friends wanted to be bankers, which I thought was hilarious because I didn't know there was investment banking. So when everybody was talking about being a banker, I thought they wanted to be a bank teller. And I was like, why would, doesn't make any sense to me. Why do you want to be a bank teller for JP Morgan or Goldman Sachs or whatever? So I was in a sort of a parallel universe through Stanford compared to a lot of my peers, and then went to the Marine Corps, and that was a really transformative experience. Certainly from a leadership standpoint, I didn't appreciate at the time how important leadership is, how no one really teaches it outside of probably the Marine Corps. The Marine Corps is probably one of the only organizations in the world that spends 6 months training every new, you know, employee on how to be a leader. And I think that that's something that is probably the most overlooked aspect of society is leadership training. And everybody talks about it, but I think it is probably done the worst of every sort of skill you could develop as a business person. I think leadership is the most poorly taught and the most important. So, you know, ended up out of the Marines. Didn't know what to do after you get out of the Marines. Learning how to kill people is not particularly helpful. in right and in becoming a into society, and I'd run a sniper platoon, so I was very focused on that part of the Marine Corps, and sort of found my way into technology, and actually, funny enough, became an expert on fiber optic telecommunications componentry assembly and the automation of that in the late 90s. So I went around the world to England and China and Japan and taught people about this very specific approach to reducing the cost of fiber optic communication components through automation, which was bizarre, but I think was also sort of a set me up for eventually for Elliptico, because at that company I met my co-founder and our head of sales at Elliptico. So the Elliptico management team, three quarters of it comes from that company, where we were focused on making $500,000 pieces of equipment for, you know, Hitachi and JES Uniphase and Nortel Networks and AT&T, and all these huge companies were buying our really expensive equipment. And I was tasked with developing new products there. So it was my job to go around the world and find out why these people couldn't automate the assembly of these telecommunications components, and then how we could deliver systems that could do it, which ultimately was a really good useful skill for trying to create our own industry of elliptical biking, because a lot of those skills actually transferred. So I did that for a couple of years, but my whole family background's in law. My parents were both judges. My older brother's a lawyer. You know, my cousins are all lawyers or judges. It's just crazy. So I always knew I was going to go to law school, and I assumed I'd be a lawyer. Once I got to law school, I pretty quickly realized I was not going to be a lawyer, but I thought I'd be a law professor. And so went through Columbia and had a great time in New York City. One thing I learned is that if you can go to school when you're like 30, it is awesome. Awesome. If you can make that happen, and you don't have real responsibilities and kids and all that, if you can like be single and go to New York City to school when you're 30, it can be three of the best years of your life. So I did that. And then the first sort of step on the process to being a law professor is usually you clerk for a judge. And so it's a competitive process, and I was very lucky to get a slot. And so I got this slot to clerk for this judge, and I hated it. I hated it. It was a disaster. It was sort of the first thing in my life that I was like, whoa, I'm really in the wrong place. And you're committed for a year. You're not as committed as like you're committed in the Marine Corps, but you're committed. Like, they won't let you out of it. You can't just quit being a law clerk. I tried to quit being a law clerk, but it's really structured. They do 1 year rotations, and it's just like the optics of having a clerk quit are a big deal. And it just, at the end of the day, this was supposed to be like a stepping stone to an even better clerkship. So there were a lot of people that had gone to bat for me to get me this clerkship. And there was a lot of drama around how much I was struggling with it. So, I mean, it was one of those things where you're driving home from work and you hope someone runs a red light and hits you. No, I'm not kidding. It was like looking out the window being like, maybe, I wonder if there's a way you could break this window and just jump out. Because this is just, I mean, I went into therapy, whole nine yards. It was a really, really bad experience for me. Everyone else loves their clerkships. You talk to a lawyer who clerks and they're like, oh my God, clerking was the best. I had this wonderful thing. My dad clerked. He thought it was the greatest thing ever. You know, all my mentors had these clerkships and it was wonderful. And so I'm the weird dude who just from day one, from the moment I walked into that job, I was like, this is the wrong place for me.
So Brett, I got to stop you there though. Was that sort of hard for your parents to accept that you were in essence rejecting the family business, and much less, I mean, you know, both your parents are judges, right? And so, I mean, you were basically on the first rung, a really hard to attain first rung that people pursued on their way to the Supreme Court. And you decided you wanted out.
Correct. And not only that, it wasn't just my parents. It was like friends of theirs had made calls on my behalf to get me this clerkship. The dean of the law school. So I did 2 years at Columbia, and then my third year I was a visiting scholar at a school called McGeorge, which is because my wife was in medical school at UC Davis, which is down in Sacramento. So I want to be in Sacramento as opposed to commuting from New York City to Sacramento, which is what I was doing my second year of law school. So I got my clerkship in Sacramento at like the absolute premier guy you could clerk for in the Eastern District of California. And not to get sidetracked on who he is, but at the end of the day, it was like the clerkship to get. And the dean of McGeorge helped me get it. And Anthony Kennedy taught at McGeorge for a number of years before he was on the Supreme Court. He was based out of the Eastern District. And the judge I was clerking for is good friends with him. So there was a path, like I was sort of like, and the dean of the law school was good friends with Anthony Kennedy. And that's sort of how you land Supreme Court clerkships, to your point. And so there was a lot of people and if you get a Supreme Court clerkship, you write your ticket in the law. Wherever you want to go, but if you want to teach and you've clerked the Supreme Court, you can teach. You can't necessarily teach at Harvard, but you can teach for sure. You can get a job at pretty much any law firm. So it's a great track to be on. And so, yeah, there was a ton of institutional inertia pushing, tying their hopes. And I had, aspirations of doing that. I mean, that was part of the plan. That was why I felt super lucky to get this clerkship. And I had sort of these stars were aligning for me. And so, yeah, I'll never forget when I turned down the first round interview process to clerk for Kennedy. And it was, there's a multi-step process. So I didn't get even in, like, I got to step one of the process, and that's where I said, this is not for me, which based on my conversation with the woman who was setting up this interview was something that I don't think she'd heard before, but it was the truth. It was like, no, I'm not, I'm going to take a left turn. Like, this is not, I'm not going to spend the next 3-4 years of my life, like wanting to jump out of a window or get hit by a car on my way home from work. Like, that doesn't make any sense to me. And yes, everyone was very disappointed, and many, many, many conversations with multiple people, long hours, tears in some cases, which when you look back, you're like, how ridiculous is that? Like, I'm going to do fine. Who cares? Like, who cares? Like, there's not one path in the world, right? Like, who cares? Like, it's not that big of a deal. But when you're sort of in it, it feels like a big deal. But once you get beyond it, you look back and you're like, that's just a bunch of silliness. Who cares? Anthony Kennedy's going to be fine. Don't worry about it. Like, he's going to find 4 clerks. Doesn't have to be me. I'm going to be fine. Don't worry about it. Like, if I'd have quit, the world would not have ended for anyone as much as everyone thought the world was going to end. So, and that's actually a good life lesson for me is that you don't have to do what seems like the obvious, path, if that's not the path that resonates with you, regardless of how many people seem invested in you doing that path, it's not going to be much better. I wouldn't be, I sort of believe you're kind of as happy as you are, and it doesn't really matter how sort of quote unquote as successful you are, you're sort of going to be as happy as you are. So whether, Steve Jobs is always going to sort of be unhappy, right? Elon Musk is sort of always going to be unhappy. It just is who they are. And there's people who like are always sort of going to be happy. And like, I don't know. I don't think you necessarily have to be super successful in order to feel like you've accomplished something. Because at the end of the day, all those things are sort of not very important.
Brian, you kind of touched on it in a way earlier, your kind of move into the marine scene and the leadership, I guess, and the intensity of that, I guess, as well, of almost the equivalent in some ways, I guess, of studying, but obviously on the ground, but it's quite compressed. I guess 2 questions. What did you pick up from that as part of your kind of DNA that you then took beyond that particular learning and part of your career? And the second question is, why did you move out of that?
Those are great questions. So I think the biggest lesson I learned from my Marine Corps experience was to put things in perspective. Because in the Marine Corps, fundamentally, the stakes are, there are stakes that are meaningful. If you do something stupid, someone can die, right? That's a real thing in the Marine Corps. And especially if you're in charge of a platoon and you're going to go into combat, if you don't, you could do everything right and people still could die. So the stakes are just really, really high. And they therefore make sort of the rest of stakes in life look not so high. So I think it gives good perspective on what success and failure are, and helps, really helps me function well in situations that seem really stressful. Like, we've had a recall before. We had 8,000 bikes in the field where the factory, sort of a long story, and I think if we had to do it all over again, we probably wouldn't have done a recall, but the factory failed to weld one fork together well. And so we had a fork come apart in the field and we freaked out and we're like, oh my gosh, we got to recall 8,000 bikes. And at the end of the day, that could have been a super stressful event and it required a lot of work. But in the grand scheme of things, it wasn't, I mean, we needed to execute, but if Elliptico goes out of business, like, that's not, like, I'm going to be fine. Like, it, no one's going to die if Elliptico goes out of business, right? So the just the stakes of everything after you've been in that level of an intense life experience, I think just the stakes seem lower for some reason.
Right, right.
Right? You sort of like, I sort of feel like I'm living on borrowed time. When you join the Marine Corps and you sort of go in the infantry and you're running a sniper platoon, in the back of your head the whole time, you're sort of like, yeah, I may get killed in this process. So when you don't, you sort of come out the other end and you're like, well, that's cool. I made it through. I didn't get killed. And therefore I'm sort of, you know, I call it living on borrowed time, but it's sort of like you sort of won the bet. So now everything else is kind of downhill from there.
Just another question there, Brian, before you go on to how you moved. What about the, and I guess I see it on the UK side, I have family in, at Sandhurst, or gone through Sandhurst. What about the human side? Because you're suddenly immersed, you know, leaving college into managing, you know, teams beyond a beliefs. What about the learning there and what you could give to us?
Yeah, so again, that's where it comes back to leadership. That's the fundamental thing the Marine Corps tries to teach young officers for the first 6 months of their career. So the way the Marine Corps structure is, every single officer goes to a thing called the basic school, and it's 6 months long, and the whole point of the basic school is to teach leadership. And then you have a follow-on school that teaches you what you're supposed to know. So I went through the basic school, and then I went through infantry officer's course, which is another 12 weeks, which is primarily leadership, but sort of ramped up to the infantry level now. And then I actually went to an intelligence course at the Army. So I went to an Army intelligence course for 4 months after that. So I did like over a year of training before delivering any value back to the Marine Corps, which is insane as an employer to get my head around training someone for a year before they do their job. This is lunacy. But that's what they do in the Marine Corps. So, and it was a great contrast to finish after, you know, 9 months of Marine training to end up at an Army base where you recognize, like, whoa, these kids do not get 6 months of hardcore leadership instruction. This is a little, this organization is a little different from the organization that, you know, I'm a part of. But ultimately, I think what you really grasp from that experience is how to lead and how to recover from mistakes. You make a lot of mistakes. I mean, I walked into a platoon of, everyone in my platoon had already been in the Marine Corps, at least done one deployment, which, so it means they've been at the unit for 2 years. So they've been through boot camp, through their infantry training, they've been at the unit, they've been selected to be a sniper. Most of them have been through sniper school. Some of them had kids, half of them were older than me. And so you walk in like fresh off the boat, you have no idea what you're doing. I'll never forget day one, literally day one of checking in the battalion. The battalion had just come back from deployment. Our battalion was known as the Rapid Recall Battalion, which was a joke because most people were on vacation. So like we couldn't have rapidly responded to anything, but because we just come back from deployment, we were really well trained. So theoretically, it's like there's something that exploded around the world, like our battalion would be one of the first to deploy because we were ready, like reinforcement. So as part of that, the sniper platoon had to attach snipers to the different companies in case a company level deployment happened. They would take some snipers with them. There's terminology in the Marine Corps that's very precise: attach and assign. Attachment means I'm responsible for them logistically, but they are part of the unit that they're being attached to from an operational standpoint. Assign means the unit they're going to gets both, sort of the logistics piece and the operational sort of tactical piece. And so I just wrote this one document to all the company commanders, and I used the word assign, but literally what I meant was attached. And I handed it out. And about 20 minutes later, I'm literally meeting my new boss, and this person I've never met before, who's a captain, walks into this office and starts yelling at me, like just top of his lungs. I don't know who the F Lieutenant Pate is, but he needs to unscrew himself from, just gets up in my kitchen and starts making breakfast. Never met this guy. Literally have no idea who this human being is. I'm meeting my boss for the first time, and this guy is reading me the riot act as only a Marine officer can read the riot act. And it was because I'd used the term assigned when I meant attached. And I think that's actually what makes the Marine Corps great, is that you don't get away with little tiny errors, because attention to detail is everything. And I mean, to this day, that happened to me 25 years ago. To this, I will always remember Captain Al and the first time I met Captain Al from Alpha Company, and attached versus assigned. Like that is ingrained in me. And that experience, I think, is for me, has always encapsulated what's great about the Marine Corps, is how much everyone cares. And he wasn't doing that to be a jerk. He was doing that to inform this brand new lieutenant that he was in the real Marine Corps now, and he needed to pay attention, because if he didn't, somebody could get killed. And it sounds insignificant, assigned versus attached, but if you're going to mess that up, then maybe you're going to load live ammo into a magazine that's supposed to have blank ammo in it, and you're going to shoot a kid, which happened during our workup. Right? Maybe you're going to try to clear a gun in the wrong way and take a round right through your shoulder, which happened in our workup. Right? So there's real danger there, and there needs to be an appreciation of the importance of doing things right. And so that's something that I think the Marine Corps really delivers that message well. And it's an important message to deliver, I think, especially in the Marine Corps. And that's sort of translated, not the ferocity of the correcting people, but the attention to detail is something I think that has continued with me and really helped through law school and especially in the legal world, because there is a real importance on attention to detail in that particular discipline.
But you did all this, and it sounds like you thoroughly enjoyed it all, but then you decided to move on.
Yeah, it's weird. The Marines have a philosophy of only junior people and really only enlisted people get to what I call kick down doors. And everybody else sort of, does paperwork, especially once you get above the rank of captain. You get to be in charge of larger and larger organizations, but it's rare for someone who's a major or lieutenant colonel to actually engage physically with the enemy or engage physically in the Marine Corps the way that sergeants do or lieutenants do. And so I was in this really weird MOS that it was called ground intelligence. And so you become an infantry officer and then you become an intelligence officer. And the path after you run your sniper platoon is typically to become an intelligence officer, which is very desk bound. And so it was the late 90s. Nothing was going on. The world was peaceful. It was going to be peaceful for 50 years. What are you going to do in the Marine Corps if there's no war going on for the next 50 years, right? Literally, that's what I was thinking. So I got out in 2000, right? Or actually December of 99. Was technically, I think, when I separated. And I mean, at that point, the biggest thing that had happened was like Albania, which I'm sure none of you guys remember. So nothing was happening, and there was no way anything was going to happen. The U.S. and Russia were friends. What could go wrong? And then I found myself decompressing from sort of the focus on killing people. And I found it to be, I didn't know how people lived in the reserves. I didn't know how you function in the Marine Corps reserves, where you sort of about thinking about killing people one weekend a month. That was a hard, it was for me, it was like my last year in the Marines, I actually spent on a Navy base. And that was really healthy, I think, because I don't think Marines appreciate, for at least I'll speak for myself, I didn't recognize how much of a traumatic event it is just being in the Marine Corps and thinking about perfecting the art of killing people. And so it took me a solid year to what I call decompress from that. And that was this year I spent on a Navy base as an intelligence officer. And I think that was once I had done that and then 9/11 happens, it's sort of like, I didn't want to go through that reverse compression again. It's like, that could have been really bad. And I think candidly, like I'd have been one of the dumb guys that did something stupid and got killed. So I was very lucky with being in the Marine Corps when I was. I don't know that I would have been successful beyond what I managed to do when I was in there.
You're fascinating.
So tell us then, so you go from the Marines, then you go to law school, and then you come out. And was that when you, and you're a clerk, you decide you don't like that, and then you go to McKinsey, right?
Yeah. Yeah, so literally I'm clerking, I'm miserable. I start calling friends of mine. I'm like, dude, I got to get out of this. I got to get out of this thing. What am I going to do with my life? And they're like, oh, you should go to McKinsey. Like four people in a row. And then I looked at my little LinkedIn and sort of friend network, and there were like 12 people I knew who worked at McKinsey. And so literally I called my old roommate from deployment, great guy, a guy named Greg Parsons, who'd gone to really interesting. So he'd gone to Princeton, played rugby there, and his dad was Richard Parsons, who was running Time Warner AOL at the time. The CEO of Time Warner AOL's kid was my roommate on deployment. And he went on to go work at McKinsey. So I call up Greg. I'm like, dude, everybody says I should go to McKinsey. And he's like, yes, you should. Where do you want to work? I was like, Silicon Valley, because my wife had gotten a residency at Stanford. So I said, I want Silicon Valley. He's like, done. So he calls up. He's like, arranges for an interview. And I go to an interview. And sure enough, I get hired. So, and then, you know, I had no idea. I had never heard of McKinsey before these people told me to work for it. And I had no idea how deeply tied it is to almost everything interesting that happens in the world at almost every level, geopolitically, business, nonprofit, across the board. It is unbelievable. My experience was, I was shocked at the range of endeavors that the firm participates in, the quality of the individuals there, the leadership focus that they have, the focus on sort of the life experience and quality training of each individual there is I think it's got to be one of the top organizations for that in the business environment. So it was really, I'm really glad my friends pushed me there. The problem was, at the same time I was developing Elliptigo. So I thought of Elliptigo while I was clerking, and I'd already filed a patent on it, and we were getting a bunch of interest. And so I was trying to have this like dual world of working for McKinsey, which is a hard job, and then starting a company, which is a hard job. So I had these two hard jobs sort of competing for each other at the same time. And I ultimately concluded, like, McKinsey's not going anywhere. If Elliptigo blows up, I'll just come back. And I'm never going to get a chance to like start my own company again. Not that I ever thought about starting my own company, but like, might as well try it. It's cool. It's a bike. I love bikes. I mean, it's sort of invented for me, and it could be a big thing. Might as well try the thing that's more interesting. So that was really the rationale.
Okay. So tell us then, why did you do Elliptigo? Where did the idea come from, and what prompted you to think that there was something there?
Yeah. So I'm not an athlete by any means, but I was sort of a recreationally competitive runner, maybe. and got into long distance triathlon. So worked up to doing an Ironman. And
that makes you an athlete, by the way, Brian.
Well, we can have an argument about what an athlete is, but I enjoyed running and I enjoyed endurance, you know, endurance stuff, hiking, like climbing mountains, all that sort of stuff. But at the end of the day, I found that whether it was football or the Marine Corps or whatever, I can't run anymore. And I lost the ability to run actually when I was 32. So in 2005, when I was clerking, I could no longer go for like a 3-mile run. Like my hips and my knees, it turns out I have hip impingements. So I'm missing three, what are they called? Little things, menisci. The little, I don't have the little rubber insulators in my knees anymore, mostly from football and soccer. And then I was born with hip impingements. So the way my, I think it's my femur, is the ball of my femur is shaped. It doesn't fit into my hip sockets well. And so when I run, my bones actually bang into each other in my hips. And I don't have cartilage, or I don't have meniscuses in my knees that are acting like little socks. So it took a long time for all of that to play out, like 32 years. But at 32, my hips and knees were like basically, every time I went for a run, it felt like I'd run a marathon. I mean, literally, I'd run 3 miles, I'd take 2 days to recover from it. It was ridiculous. So I started using the elliptical trainer. And even though I spent a lot of time on road bikes, I never liked road bikes. I never liked the outfits. I didn't like the seats. They were just always uncomfortable. And candidly, I didn't really like cycling culture. It's just a really different culture than running culture. And I just wanted to run. And so I ended up doing the elliptical trainer. And I found that I hated being in a gym, but I really liked the fact that the elliptical trainer felt more like running and I could really push it hard. But it quickly made me realize that for the rest of my life, I was just going to exercise to eat, that there was never going to be like a goal. Like never going to be something to train for. I was just going to be exercising for the sake of exercising, which was a totally foreign concept. I'd always trained to play soccer or trained to run a marathon or do an Ironman or whatever. There was always a goal for training. And then that was kind of taken away from me, so to speak, when I couldn't run anymore. I didn't want to go into cycling. And then I was on an elliptical machine trying to break it. So every time I got on an elliptical machine, my goal was to break the machine. And I finally met a guy who broke two elliptical machines. He's like one of my heroes, this guy named Adam Goucher. He was an unbelievable runner who was always hurt.
And husband to Kara.
Yes, the husband to Kara. And he broke two gym quality elliptical machines.
Wow. Which is
unbelievable if you know anything about those. So Michael,
how do you break them, Brian? Did.
So I don't know. I was never successful at breaking them. I don't recall, Adam explained it to me, it was years ago, and I don't recall how he broke them, but when we were chatting about breaking elliptical machines, he laughed, and he said, yeah, actually, I've broken two, and we sort of had a bonding moment over being on an elliptical machine so much and hating it so much that you actually physically break it, and so it just hit me. I was like, oh my gosh, someone must make an elliptical trainer you can ride on the street. Like, that thing must exist in the world. It's something that should be there. And so this was May of 2005, and I went back and just Googled it, and I started Googling, and I couldn't believe it. I was like, it blew my mind that I couldn't buy an elliptical trainer to ride on the street. And so then my sort of marketing hat got put on, and I was like, well, what could be the size of this market? How many runners have to give up running because of injury? You know, what, like, could this thing work? And so I spent about a month doing research on it, and it was clear to me that there's at least 1 million runners that are forced to give up running every year because of injury. And in fact, 80% of runners who are running at the age of 40 will have to give it up by the time they hit 65. That's how steep the drop-off is for running. It's unbelievable how many people have to give up running between 40 and 65. So it was a huge market opportunity. And that started to get me interesting. Plus, I was in this miserable job. So I was clerking. I was definitely looking for a distraction from clerking. So it kind of gave me a little bit of something else to work on. I was lucky enough that one of the guys from a new product team that I worked at with the semiconductor company, the capital equipment company that I mentioned before, Brent, was an ultra marathoner, done an Ironman, was a mechanical engineer. So I had a guy I could go to that I'd worked with before to sort of be like, hey, is this a doable thing? You know, could you make an elliptical trainer you could ride on the street? And so that's how it all sort of came together. It was just, I wanted one. I was willing to pay. The first one cost me $30,000. Cost me $30,000 of total cost to get to the, what we call Charlie, which was really the first rideable elliptico. Now, most of that went to patent fees, because we were filing patents. But I still, by the time I actually got the physical solution to my problem, which was Charlie, which I got in 2008, it was our second prototype we built. You know, I was into it $30,000, and I was like, this is the best $30,000 I'll ever spend, because now I at least have a solution for the rest of my life. Because worst case, I could probably talk Brent into letting me have Charlie if this thing all blows up, and then I have a something I can stay fit on for the rest of my life. Like, I've sort of solved my problem. And then, of course, after that, I gave myself a job, and now I've been paying myself to sell ellipticos for 10 years.
So, Brian, in short, though, the development of that, you said you hadn't seen anything out there.
Yeah.
What drove you, though, in terms of, and we talk about, you know, what I wish I knew, and people out there now listening to you, what is it about you in that particular process, if you like, and what could we take from that to say, hey, you know, this is a really important insight into how I act through the day and into how I look at my career. What would you offer us there?
Well, I think I'm really lucky in the sense that I found someone who had a completely complementary set of skills to me. So I'm the lawyer, marketing, sort of business finance guy. He's the engineer. I can't build anything. Brent would have probably a tougher time than I do raising money, for example, dealing with lawsuits and things like that. So we have a nice skill set. It's a hard process. I don't have a great answer to your question, because I feel like I'm sort of an unintentional entrepreneur. I heard a podcast once by the guys who created Uma, and they actually had it as their mission to create a company, and it just happened to be Uma, because they did a ton of research and they decided that was the area to go into, telecommunications and this sort of IP-based telephone system. That is bizarre to me. I don't know who in their right mind would do that, because this process is really hard. It is not lucrative so far. I think I'm just really lucky that I had the network I did to get me with Brent, somebody who could provide the skill sets that I didn't have, and then also be in a position where we could raise money and sort of turn this thing into a real product. We both left more lucrative careers in terms of the economics of it. How I get through the day is just, I feel like I'm doing something good every day. Like, that's what drives me. It's like, at the end of the day, probably my biggest downside as an entrepreneur is I don't care that much about money, which is probably a problem. And ultimately, I'll probably need to be replaced as the CEO because of that. As we start to scale, somebody who cares more about money should probably be driving the business as it scales. I'm more interested in, number one, the selfish question of, was I right? Like, should this thing exist? There's a little bit of just intellectual curiosity around, like, is the world the way the way I think it is, which is a place where an elliptical bike will become a huge part of society. I'm very curious about that. And then number two, I love the people that are involved in this organization. The employees are amazing. The customers are unbelievable. And the volume of like goodwill that flows back to us from our customer base is unbelievable. And I don't know that there are many non-charity things you could do that could create as much sort of goodwill feedback as selling bikes that change people's lives. I mean, there's so many people out there that had to give up running, and that was the most depressing event in their life. And then we deliver them a product that lets them feel like they're running again, and it totally changes who they are. And they're super appreciative of that. And so there's just a lot of like warmth and goodwill that sort of flows around day-to-day life at Elliptico. Now, it sucks working at Elliptico because it sucks working everywhere, right? Like, I do a bunch of things that I would not want to do when I work at Elliptico. Like, you know, we get sued every once in a while. That sucks. We have to run the quarterly financing, like, you know, accounting. Like, that sucks. I don't want to look at my P&L and my balance sheet every day, but I do, right? Because it's part of my role running the business. We, you know, have to let people go. That's the worst thing ever. But so I'm not saying it's all roses, but ultimately, like, every job sucks. This job just happens to have a ton of positive elements to it that I feel like would be hard to replicate in some other job.
That's pretty cool, Brian. I mean, in a way, your entrepreneurial journey was different maybe than others. And from hearing you describe, you know, some people you know where they were probably more kind of looking for opportunities and using that as the path in, as opposed to what you were doing is trying to solve a problem. So it's almost like the orientation to what caused you to become an entrepreneur, right?
Yes. So I did not have any interest in being an entrepreneur. I had an interest of solving my own problem of not being able to run. That led me to identify like a need for other people that I at least still believe. I still believe there's a bunch of other people who need this solution too. And the mechanism to deliver that solution to the other people was to start a company. The original mechanism was actually to develop the prototypes, file a bunch of patents, and then license the concept to other companies. And then I was going to go back to working at McKinsey or never leave McKinsey. I mean, this was not the path that Brent and I had envisioned when we started on this thing. We both agreed the thing should exist. We were both surprised it didn't. And we thought there was an opportunity to develop it and bring it into the world. Neither of us was particularly enthused about starting a company. I think since we've started a company, we see there's a lot of benefits to having started a company from a life experience standpoint. It's a very interesting thing to do. I feel like it has allowed me to make a bigger sort of contribution to individuals' lives, many of whom are people that I care about, than I would have if I was working at McKinsey or left McKinsey to go work at Google or something, which is sort of the typical path that, you know, consultants take. But it wasn't a thought out, you know, identification of like, we're going to find a problem in the world, we're going to deliver a solution, and we're going to fund it and then launch it and then sell it and retire and buy our own island or whatever.
So have you ever reached a point, you know, in your journey with Elliptico, Brian, where you felt like we've made it, you know, it's definitely, you know, locked in. And I wonder, I mean, does that give you, I mean, I guess the question I'm really trying to ask, Brian, is do you ever reach a point where it's the ego benefit is higher than, you know, maybe the other rewards that, you know, that may come from it? Or do you feel like being an entrepreneur is ultimately also a humbling experience?
Interesting. So you asked a couple of questions there, and I really liked your first one of like, have you ever reached a point where you've made it at Elliptico? And the answer is definitely no. And I don't know that there is, like, I don't think that point actually exists for anyone. Like, Steve Jobs probably never felt like he made it, right? I think I feel like people who are trying to achieve on a daily basis are either just getting better or getting worse. You're either like improving or getting worse. And so you're always sort of either trending towards success or trending away from success, depending on what you choose to do that day. Like, you're just either getting better or worse. You're never achieving success or failure. You never really fail because you just learn, like, whatever process you tried didn't work. That's actually progress. Like, failure is usually progress. That's usually the path people take to actually succeed. So it's not like you ever fail or succeed. You just sort of like today you either got better or today you got worse. That's how I approach it. Elliptico, we try to get better, but hey, some days we get worse. But overall, I'd say our trend line has been towards getting better in every facet of the company. But I don't think we'll ever succeed as a company. I don't think that's a real thing. I think we will continue to trend towards success. In terms of are we doing this for the ego of it or the material benefits? I don't think of it that way. I think the team is doing it because we have a real sense of purpose. I think ultimately everybody, so our company's interesting. We have 12 employees. 7 of us have been there for 10 years or more. 2 people have been there for, 1 for 5, 1 for 6. And then 3 are new. 3 have been there for less than a year. And the core group of 7 that have been there forever, really from the beginning, all of us 100% care about each other and our customers and the success of this industry. Like, we're in it because we think it's really important. You know, we just believe that this is like an important thing to happen in the world. Like, we believe we've helped so many people and there's so many more people that need to be helped. It's like, we sort of need to do this. And I don't know if you call that a calling. I don't think it's a calling for us, like being a doctor or something. But for people who don't really have an option but to work for companies, I think this is the one we feel like there's just a caring or purpose behind what we do every day. Like, our people care about the customers. They care about the product. They care about each other in the company. And so I really think that's why they're there. I think the economics are well in the background of all that. Like, if we sell a company and all those people make money and then the company turns to crap, they will be more disappointed than if we just, you know, make mediocre salaries for the rest of our lives but feel like we're doing good things.
That's fascinating. And Brian, in terms of the international piece, and, you know, as a marketer, I kind of look at this and say this is a classical delivering an unmet need. Yeah, it's kind of saying, hey, people are going to the gym. They're used to the elliptico, the elliptic cycle. You know, what don't they know? I mean, do you see that again? Thinking of what you take out of that, it sounds like your platforming and an approach as a kind of evangelical piece here. You know, going around and introducing it as a kind of aha. Is that what you would kind of reflect on yourself for and suggest that people need to, in the world with what they're selling or marketing, etc., need to think about?
So I don't know how well our experience at Elliptico translates into other product categories, because it is unusual to deliver a totally new concept. For us, awareness is our biggest challenge. And then after awareness is something we call legitimacy. So most people who need our product actually don't even know it exists. The ones who do need it, who don't own it, that know it exists, don't own it because they don't believe it's actually going to deliver what it delivers. So we haven't convinced them of the legitimacy of the product. And those are our two biggest marketing tasks. And they're really hard. And if you look at the history of products like ours, whether it's mountain bikes, electric bikes, stand-up paddleboard, snowboarding, like every 5 to 10 years, there's some new category that develops within outdoor recreation and fitness. And it, you know, it's an overnight success. Well, stand-up paddleboards have been around for 50 years before they actually became popular. Mountain bikes have been around for 12 before they became popular. Snowboarding had been around for 40 years before it became popular. I mean, these things just take a really long time, or they can take a really long time to develop, to overcome those two issues, awareness and legitimacy, right? Because the first time you see, you know, a snowboard, you're sort of like, what is that thing? And why would I ever do it? Like, I'm a skier. So there's just, it takes a while to get enough momentum. And then all of a sudden it's like, oh, of course I'm a snowboarder. Everybody's a snowboarder. It's way better than skiing. It's so much more comfortable. It's more fun, blah, blah, blah. And you get the tipping point and the explosion, the geometric expansion that really only consumer products can deliver. So I think we fight in that way. We fight that same battle that any new category person is going to fight, which is awareness and legitimacy. And I think there's a great book by a guy named Brian Smith, who is the founder of Uggs. So Ugg Footwear, he wrote a book, and it's called, I can't remember what the book is called, but his theme is, you can't give birth to an adult. You can't give birth to an adult. Like, you have to give birth to a child, and then that, you know, that infant baby has to grow into becoming an adult, and that takes time. And there's nothing you can do about it. You have to go through all those phases. And companies that get to adulthood quicker just go through those phases quicker. But there's all these phases you have to go through. And I think that message is right. Like, you, as much as we want Elliptigo in year one to become this boom explosion in the world, nah, it's a baby, right? We got to cultivate it. We got to nurture it. It needs a lot of love, care, and feeding. It can't be out on its own. Now we're 10. So we're like, you know, an old child or a young adolescent. I don't know. I don't have kids, so I don't know what a 10-year-old is, but we're at that point where, like, we sort of know what we're doing, but not really. Like, we still don't have clout in Asia. We still don't have any leverage over our production. Distributors still don't want to carry us. I mean, we're still a bastard 10-year-old, you know, kid who nobody likes. So we got to get into becoming a good-looking 22-year-old. And then people start liking us, and we can blossom and explode.
So what does it feel like then, Brian, when you see someone somewhere else, let's just say, I mean, since you're based in the San Diego area, but somewhere else in the world, what does it feel like when you see someone you don't know using a product that wouldn't be there if not for you?
It's cool. So that is one of the total highlights of this job. So happened to me last weekend. There was a woman, I rode to Oceanside Pier and back in the morning. And on my way back, there was a woman, she was probably 75. And she was cruising along on her 8C, her Elliptigo 8C. And she had no idea who I was, right? I'm just like a dude on an Elliptigo. And now there's enough in San Diego that, like, Elliptigo riders see each other and we wave, and I usually know them. But it's, like, so cool to me that this woman was out there just having the time of her life, getting in a great workout, huge smile on her face. I pull up next to her. I was like, right on, Elliptigo. And she's like, woo. I said, you having fun? She's like, I love it. And then I was just like, that's cool. So that is one of those sort of unique, you just don't get that if you're, there's few products you sort of get that sort of rush. And it's been, I'll never forget the first person riding an Elliptigo I saw who I didn't know who he was this Italian kid in Coronado on 4th of July, like 2010. And he was riding along, actually the street I grew up on. So he was riding along the street I grew up on. My wife and I were walking back from lunch to my folks' house. And he had these four Italian girls chasing him. He was on an Elliptigo, and he had the biggest smile on his face, and he's cruising out. He's like a 16, 17-year-old kid, these girls. And so I said, what do you think of that thing? And he says, ah, it is so beautiful. And just had this, like, great smile on his face, and then kept going. And I looked at my wife, and I was like, that was one of the coolest experiences of my life. You know, it was just like out of the blue. My wife and I are just walking back from lunch, you know, not a care in the world. And all of a sudden we look up and we're like, there's a guy on an Elliptigo, like, riding towards us. And by this time, I've been working on this project for 5 years. So it was, you know, a lot of blood, sweat, and tears and arguments and money and, you know, stress and all that stuff. And so it sort of encapsulated, you know, we've actually done something here. That kid's having a good day and he'd be doing something different if it wasn't for the time, effort, and energy we put in over the last 5 years. So that one was particularly cool. And it is, I get a rush every time I see an Elliptigo rider, especially someone I don't know.
That's awesome. So that's interesting, Brian. Your passion here is, you know, I could feel it over the sound waves here. But I also get the sense that you are in the backdrop very determined. And also, I also get the sense, all that learning you had, you know, McKinsey, military school, etc. You talked about this calmness along the way in the face of a storm, I think, is, mm-hmm. and you described that a bit differently earlier. But is that ultimately what it's about too? You know, if you've got the idea and you're pushing it, and like you alluded to, if things come your way that are not what you want or not what you intend, you've just got to keep a strong road ahead.
Yeah. I don't think you can be successful as an entrepreneur without a lot of resilience and determination. And I think that there's every entrepreneur is going to have really bad things that happen to them, most of which are out of their control. So I think you have to have this, the determination and ability to stay sort of calm, cool, and collected, both when things are going really well and when things are going really poorly. I think it's helpful to have a perspective of, you know, of things aren't as bad as they seem and things aren't as good as they seem. There's a guy named Sir William Slim, who is a famous military leader, who always said, the situation is never as good or as bad as first report. That it's never, things are never as good or bad as you think they are when you first learn about them. Like human beings, we just, things are not what they seem, and good things are never quite as good. There's always a catch. And bad things are really never quite as bad. Like, there's a great book, The Hard Things About Hard Things, which is Horowitz's book, from Andreessen Horowitz. And he talks about, things are never as good or as bad as first reported. I apologize.
That's okay.
That was embarrassing. But, back to, I think, the determination and just willingness to continue through the process, even when it looks like things are, you know, horrible, and not to get overwhelmingly impressed with yourself when things seem to be going really well. And the thing that Horowitz talked about was, every startup he's seen, there are always three times where everyone concludes that the startup is done, that it's literally done, where they all look, you know, the management team sit around the table and they look at it and they're like, this is it. This is where we go out of business. And the startups that are successful are ones that survive that experience. And we've had three at Elliptigo. There have been three times at Elliptigo where I was 100% certain we were done. My wife and I sort of like celebrated / commiserated, cried over the last one was a year ago. And we like looked at each other, we're like, this is it. It's over. It's been 9 years of selling bikes, but this is it. And like somehow the successful entrepreneurs are able to function in, you're able to hold two beliefs at the same time. Number one, there's no way I can fail. Number two, the most likely outcome is failure. You have to hold those two beliefs at the same time and sort of be okay with both simultaneously. And so when you get into the situation where it's like, you're 100% sure this thing's done, you're still iterating to figure out the path through that problem. So there's always a path through the problem, and the successful entrepreneurs are the ones who usually are lucky enough to find that path. There's always a path. The question is whether or not you can find it before you actually run out of money. And so we've been able to, the three times this has happened to Elliptico, we've found that path that allowed us to function through the client, you know, the catastrophe and get to the other side, usually in an okay place, actually. We've actually come out the other side okay.
So let me ask that, maybe it's a similar question, but if you were to rewind, Brian, to the beginning of your Elliptico journey and kind of relate that to someone who's at the front end of their own, you know, entrepreneurial journey, in an ideal world, what do you wish you had known then, or what would you wish that, or would want someone else kind of starting their own journey to know at the front end that would help carry them through?
I think one of the things, and maybe this goes back to Brian Smith's sort of, you can't give birth to an adult. I think it's helpful to start a company when you don't know what the hell you're doing. Because if you really knew, like if I really knew 15 years down the road, like I'd be sitting in my laundry room, right, with a 12-person team, like working at Elliptico. Like, I don't know. Like, I don't, like, that's not... Like if you knew that was the path and all the hardship you were going to have to go to get here, maybe you wouldn't do it. So I think there's a importance in sort of being naive enough to start a company, because I don't think it's a rational act. That certainly doesn't pencil out on an economic scale, almost no matter what your exit is. There's way more lucrative ways to like build a career than starting a company. It's not a rational decision. So I think that the important thing is to have something about what you're going to be doing that really draws you towards it. And you think it's important and you're willing to do whatever it takes. I think you have to have an attitude of, I'm willing to do whatever it takes to make this thing successful. Because if you don't, I don't think you're going to get there, because it's going to be brutal. It's going to be miserable. There's going to be a lot of really bad things that come your way that are unfair, that just the world shakes it against you. And if this is just a job, there's a lot easier jobs out there that'll pay you a lot more money. So it can't just be a job, I think, is probably the most important. This has to be like, it's back to Simon's point, like you have to be an evangelist. Like you have to be like touched by God about this thing you're trying to do. It has to piss you off that it like isn't, the world isn't the way it could be. Like it almost has to be personal. But the other thing, so you got to hold these totally conflicting thoughts together at the same time. Like it has to be very personal, but you somehow have to detach yourself from it, so that if it does blow up, it doesn't like ruin your entire personhood. Like you have to see this thing that you're so invested in as separate from yourself. Because I think, you know, a lot of entrepreneurs can get into really bad depression and mental health issues when they entwine themselves with their business so much that when something bad happens to the business, like it makes them a bad person in their own mind. So you have to hold these two thoughts also are totally against each other. Number one, this is the most important thing I could possibly be doing. And number two, if it all goes away tomorrow, that's okay. Like those are great. You have to, because otherwise it's too dangerous. Like I think it's too risky to just glob onto, this is the most important thing in the world. And if it falls apart, then I'm a total failure. It's a disaster. And everyone in the world is, you know, loses out. And it's so important, and it, like my self-esteem is built around it, and all those issues, which I think is what happens to a lot of entrepreneurs. I think they're unhealthy because of it. You kind of have to have this at the same time. While I believe all those things, if it all blows up tomorrow, like I'm gonna be okay. Like I can live on ramen. I've done it before. Like one of the great things about the Marine Corps, like Marine Corps gives you perspective on what, like how robust people are, and you know, you can be cold. It's not that big of a deal. I can live in a tent. It's not that big of a deal. I've done it before. I've lived in a tent for months on end without showering. Like it's a doable thing. I don't need this house. Like I don't need this house. I don't need my car. Like you can create a pretty simple life and be fine. So again, at the end of the day, I believe you're sort of going to be as happy as you are, whether you're living in a tent or whether you're living in this house. You're probably going to be about as happy. So it's less about the fear of like, oh, I'd lose all these things if Elliptico goes under, and more about just being like, it's super, super important for me, to me, that Elliptico is successful. Elliptico is not successful. That's okay.
Wow. Brian, this has been a fantastic, you know, conversation, and would want to carry on, you know, continuously, but we know that you're a busy man. So thanks so much for, you know, sharing your journey with us.
Yeah, right on. It's been fun. I wish I was more helpful and concise in my answers. I feel like I droned on a little bit, but it's been fun. Appreciate what you guys are doing. I hope people are listening, and the more education and insights people have, the better off they're going to be. So
yeah, I agree. Thanks, Brian. I totally agree, and I definitely got the resonance, which is why I pushed back to when you were describing your military side and why you chose some of those pieces, that's given you that tough and enabled you, if you like, throughout your career too, which is really, really important. And I was fascinated by it all. So thank you very much.
We do hope you enjoyed this podcast, and thanks for listening to What I Wish I Knew with Mike Irwin and Simon Dorr. Please join us at whatiwishiknewshow.com. You can subscribe to us on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and wherever you find your favorite podcasts.
Please share What I Wish I Knew with Mike Irwin and Simon Daw with your friends. We welcome your feedback and recommendations of new podcast guests and ideas on topics. If you have business challenges, we're also available for advisory and consulting roles. We'd be delighted to listen and help. Just send us an email. Our address is hello@whatiwishiknewshow.com.